This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Ari Shapiro, sitting in for Steve Inskeep. The labor market is expected to remain tough for many months. When jobs eventually start coming back, some areas may recover long before others. For example, healthcare and education could bounce back quickly. Construction jobs, on the other hand, could take years to return. And as NPR's Frank Langfitt reports, there are some fields where jobs are most likely gone for good.
It's the week before classes at Maryland's Montgomery College, and business at the registration office is booming.
My bill says I have a class here, but I'm not taking it.
Oh, I need to get some transcripts.
Sure.
I was told if I filled this paper out, I can get my ID now.
Most sectors of the economy shrink during a recession, but not community colleges like Montgomery. In the last academic year, the college hired more than 200 people. Enrollment for credit is expected to pass 25,000 this fall, an all-time high. Vivian Lawyer runs Human Resources.
When the economy is bad, community colleges tend to grow in enrollments because people are coming back to school to shore up their skills in various areas or to retool.
The college plans to add at least another 20 faculty this academic year.
My name is Antonio del Castillo. I'm an associate professor in biology.
Del Castillo is one of Montgomery's recent hires. He used to do government-sponsored research. Then his boss lost funding.
He was told that he had to leave that institution, and then all the people that work for him has to start looking. At that moment in time, I thought that, okay, I need to find something more stable.
Oh, 911. I think he needs to be here because he is a cardiac patient.
Another area where jobs are expected to grow is healthcare. Bill Robertson runs Adventist Healthcare, which has hospitals in Maryland and New Jersey. He says during the recession, Adventist continued to hire pharmacists, physical therapists, and ultrasound technicians.
At one of our hospitals, Washington Adventist Hospital, we have one of the largest orientations of new graduate nurses going on. I think we have 24 nursing graduates in orientation right now.
The nation's population continues to grow and age. To meet those needs locally, Adventist plans to hire another 700 people in the next 2 years. Robertson says a recession won't stop the growth in healthcare.
When you look at a 25 or 50-year horizon, which is what we have to plan on, we're always looking to say that this is going to be a growing community, and a downturn for a year or two or three does not ultimately change the vision.
Other job sectors, though, are expected to lag in any recovery. One is manufacturing. Technology, global competition, and outsourcing have destroyed jobs in industries such as autos and furniture. John Graham teaches finance at Duke and runs a business tracking survey with CFO Magazine.
Those jobs are unlikely to come back even when demand picks up because the labor is cheaper outside of the United States.
Another expected lagger, construction. Josh Bivens works for the Economic Policy Institute, a labor think tank in Washington, D.C. He says about 200,000 construction jobs should not have existed in the first place. They were created by the housing bubble. Bivens thinks buyers will have to work through the glut of foreclosed homes before builders can really start hiring again.
It's just going to take time. It's just going to take an economic recovery, but also kind of the natural process of population growth, actually more people physically needing more homes to live in. And I don't think there's anything that will really speed that up.
Will be big layoffs at Morgan Stanley. And
Bear Stearns could start to hand out thousands of pink slips this week.
The big New York investment bank Lehman Brothers has announced it will file for bankruptcy.
Aside from housing, the other field that sparked the recession was finance. Innovative products like mortgage-backed securities blew up and brought investment banks to their knees. But Jonathan Shepard says he's beginning to see a turnaround.
Every day I talk to people who are hiring or looking to hire. Absolutely.
Shepard works for Harvard Business School, where he hooks students up with financial firms. He says companies have cut so deep, they will have to bring on more staff as the economy improves.
There have been hundreds of thousands of people in the financial services industry who have been let go. So there's clearly room for some significant hiring.
Shepard says after crashes, people always ask the same question.
Is finance dead? Will it ever come back? Will anyone ever make any creative innovation? And time and again, I think the answer is, you know, yes, it comes back. Yes, it evolves. I wouldn't bet against the financial services industry.
Overall, the road to job recovery will be a long one. There are nearly 7 million fewer jobs today than at the start of the downturn. And the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a Washington think tank, has this prediction. The unemployment rate will not return to pre-recession levels until 2014. Frank Langfitt, NPR News, Washington.
There are so many layers of costs in the healthcare system, and it's difficult to pick apart what makes it so expensive. Our Planet Money team has been trying to figure it out. Today, Hannah Jaffe-Walt takes a look at medical devices and technology. They are expensive, and she asks, do they need to be?
A woman lies half conscious on her back in this room. There's beeping, there's a tube coming out of her stomach, there are at least a dozen people shuffling around, and there is one $2,000 piece of metal you could easily miss if you didn't know where to look.
So this is a medicated stent.
That's the stent?
Yeah, so you can see the stent. Maybe turn the overhead lights on.
Tiny.
Yeah, they're very small and very flexible. Why don't we turn the light down again?
Dr. Paul Tierstein focuses in on Trudy Schwelk's anatomy. There on a screen are her arteries, looking like narrow, windy tree roots. A stent is going to go in there. Tierstein assesses the size of the problem. All right, 23-millimeter stent, he calls. 23-millimeter stent, someone repeats. And then it's in his hands, and then it's in Trudy's body, threaded up an artery, around a bend, into a clogged spot. Dr. Tierstein looks back at his screen. Too big, I think.
What do you guys think? A little bit too long? Want to try an 18?
Dr. Tierstein pulls the stent back out of Trudy's arteries, out of her body, tosses it aside. 18-millimeter stent, he calls. 18-millimeter stent, someone repeats, and there it appears.
It's one of the advantages of having a lot of different stents in your cabinet. You have more chance of finding the one that, length that you like.
So what happened to that stent?
So that stent goes back to the company, and they just have to throw it away.
Dr. Tierstein's hospital in San Diego has a special deal with the stent manufacturer, so they don't have to pay for stents they don't use. But still, trashed stents raise the price of all stents. And just in this room, they can easily go through a dozen a day. There are these metal shelves rolling around on wheels, stacked full of stent boxes, rolling piles of money. And Tierstein is casual like that with all his tools. A tiny wire that looks like a piano wire annoys him during the procedure. Gets rid of it. $50. Then the catheter is not sitting correctly in the artery. Okay. Gets another.
And you really need a lot of tools to do this procedure. And they're all kind of expensive. But like this catheter is probably about $60.
This plastic thing?
Yeah, this plastic thing, exactly. Pull back. But it's, you know, it's got to be able to be torqueable, and it's got to be FDA approved.
It's bizarre to stand in here, not as the patient, not as the doctor, but as sort of an accountant. Plastic tubes are $60, and Dr. Tierstein uses 5 of them in an hour. Stents are $2,000. 1 hour goes by, he goes through 3. So the question then, I guess, is does the stent need to be $2,000? Why does it cost so much? Okay, so number one, it's got to live inside someone by their heart, so it does need to be precise, and that's expensive. It costs millions to get one of these new stents approved by the FDA, so the $2,000 price has got to make back some of that cost. But then there's this kind of simple reason. It's all new, brand new. So new, we never quite get a chance to figure out what it should cost.
Some kinds of things you see in a hospital that are used very routinely, like Band-Aids, that we understand very, very well, and they're used all the time. And, of course, the prices of those things are pretty low.
This is Ken Rogoff, an economist at Harvard.
But the kind of fine scalpels and instruments that might be used in heart surgery are really pretty new, and there are lots of different varieties, and the market's still sort of sorting itself out.
Most products over time, as we get to know them, as they get mass-produced, they get cheaper. Band-Aids, TVs, calculators. But we don't get to know scalpels and stents the way we get to know calculators. We don't really understand just how perfect they need to be. And we generally accept better medical technology is worth the cost. And because we will pay for the new, better stent, manufacturers are constantly trying to make the new, better stent. We are incredible innovators in medical technology, and we all benefit from that. The world benefits from that. We also pay for it. A lot. Hannah Jaffe-Walt, NPR News.
Let's get an update now on the latest job numbers just out this morning. The Labor Department says the economy lost 216,000 jobs in August, and the unemployment rate hit 9.7%. The report shows that while the economy continues to shed jobs, those losses are getting smaller with each month. Frank Langfitt covers labor for NPR, and he's here with us in the studio. Good morning, Frank.
Good morning, Ari.
Okay, so you've been following these numbers for a while now. What's the big message that you get from today's report?
Well, the good news is the recession is almost certainly ending. Job losses are ebbing. We're losing less and less each month, as you just said. I mean, consider at the height in January, we lost 740,000 jobs. The bad news is the labor market is just murder. People are getting stuck out there. One thing that economists are looking very closely at is long-term unemployment. That's people who've been out of work for 27 weeks or longer, and that number's continuing to rise. It's now close to 5 million. The reason's very simple. More people are losing their jobs, but employers are still nervous about the recovery, and they're not really ready to hire.
Okay, so if layoffs are ebbing, when do you think hiring might start to increase?
Well, economists often look at a couple of indicators to get a feel for that. And this is frankly the worrying part. It looks like it's going to be some time. One thing that economists look at is the work week. Right now, the average is 33.1 hours. That's close to a historic low. There hasn't been any movement in the last month. What that really means is employers cut workers' hours a lot this recession. And so they're going to have to first start restoring them before they do any new hiring. Another indicator that's really important is temporary services. And that was down this month, back in August, down 6,500 jobs. Now, companies usually start hiring temps before they bring on full-time work. So again, that's another very important indicator that has to start rising before we see a lot more permanent jobs.
Not a lot of positive signs there. And
no.
Frank, you've been reporting on the human toll of this, interviewing people around Washington, D.C. What are you hearing from them?
It's very tough out there. And keep in mind, Washington is one of the best economies in the United States. We have all this government spending, so it's really insulated to some degree from the worst parts of this recession. Still, when you talk to people, I go to a lot of these employment offices, they're really frustrated. Some people can't pay their rent anymore. They're sleeping on the couches of their children or siblings. Some have been out of work a really long time, and they're worried about losing their unemployment benefits. Also, fighting depression. People are doing a little volunteer work, exercise. But the odds of getting a job right now are really daunting. Now there are about 6 unemployed people for every job opening. So some people feel like they're just sending resumes out into an abyss.
Well, looking ahead, how many more months of job losses do you think we can expect to see?
Well, when you talk to analysts, they expect at least a few more months. They're not certain. And, of course, we've got to get this last month in August, it was 216,000. We've got to get to zero, and that could take a little while. Probably won't see hiring kick back in maybe for another 6 to 9 months, and that's based on sort of historic trends, what we've seen in the past. And that means the unemployment rate will probably continue to rise. I mean, one analyst I talked to this morning with the Economic Policy Institute, that's a labor think tank here in Washington, D.C., she estimated that unemployment would peak next summer probably at about 10.4%. So going forward, the good news is we are probably almost certainly pulling out of this recession. But getting out of it and opportunities for workers are going to be really slow in coming.
Thanks. That's NPR's Frank Langfitt. Henry Paulson became the Treasury Secretary in 2006 when the economy was humming along. The former CEO of Goldman Sachs stood out among other Washington policymakers. Here's how Vanity Fair's national editor Todd Purdom described Paulson.
He's physically a hulking, imposing presence, very tall, you know, former offensive lineman on the Dartmouth football team, and he's athletic, he's a big sportsman, avid outdoorsman, a bird watcher, and a big environmentalist who's given $100 million of his own money to environmental and conservation causes. That makes him something of an oddity among Republicans as well.
Purdom knows Secretary Paulson very well. They began holding a series of interviews in November of 2007. The condition was that Purdom not publish the interviews until Paulson was out of office. At first, they talked about issues like dealing with China and the challenges of working in Washington. And then the U.S. was hit with the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression. And they continued talking. Purdom interviewed Secretary Paulson a total of 8 times, most recently in January of this year. Those discussions are the basis of Purdom's article, Paulson's Longest Night. It's in the newest issue of Vanity Fair magazine, and Todd Purdom joined me in our studios in Washington.
Good morning, Ari.
I'd like you to start with a particularly evocative metaphor that Henry Paulson used to describe his situation. Do you know the phrase I'm referring to?
When he said, after you've been boiling in oil, it doesn't really matter what the temperature is?
Yes, that's the one. What did he mean by that exactly?
I think he meant that he was really He had a fire under him at all times, and it was impossible for him in some ways to ever get the long view. He was just in the pot, and things were bubbling, and every time he thought he'd solved one problem or plugged one hole, another one emerged, often before the end of the week, and I think that was a hard thing for him to cope with.
Yeah, you say he was not an inbox kind of a guy. He liked to think long-term. He wanted to fix major problems.
Yeah, he came hoping to do entitlement reform and work on tax overhaul and work on the relationship with China, which he believed to be of enormous strategic importance and influencing all kinds of aspects of U.S. foreign and economic policy. And he was able to do a little bit of that with China. But basically, from the minute he got there, he was bailing as fast as he could.
And he was never a particular expert in the kinds of things that he had to focus on. He was not an expert in housing?
No, nor in regulation, nor in any of the number of sectors in which he was called on to act, and he was candid in acknowledging that.
And he also acknowledged that philosophically, he came to the job thinking one thing, and pragmatically had to do something very different.
He came to the job thinking that markets could mediate risk, and he was fundamentally sort of against government intervention. And by the end, I think he felt there were a whole series of tools that would be needed in the future to regulate financial activities, or not just domestically, but globally, that future Treasury secretaries ought to be able to have.
So in all of these ways that you're describing him and that he's describing himself, it doesn't sound like he came to the job with a profile that somebody who ended up in the job he was in would need for the crisis that he had.
Except in one particular, he came to the job as a master of markets and understanding the psychology of Wall Street and the psychology of investors and the psychology of deal making. And I think in some ways, it was lucky that he was there because he was a master deal maker. He'd been used to courting CEOs all over, the CFOs all over the country and the world as an investment banker, getting their business. So when he went to Capitol Hill, he was quite practiced in the art of negotiation. And in the end, I think, due to the sheer force of his personality, as well as his understanding of what the psychology of investors would suffer if the worst had happened, I think he managed to be a sort of persuasive advocate for those questions on the Hill.
But it sounds like he had a really hard time with the culture of Washington.
I think he did have a hard time with the culture of Washington. He came of age in the business world where billion-dollar deals are sealed with a handshake and your word is your bond. I think it drove him crazy to have members of Congress say, I'd love to help you and I'm all for what you're doing, and if you really needed my vote, you'd have it. But since you don't, I'm going to take a pass, and by the way, I'll take a swipe at you on the way out the door.
People kept telling him one thing in private and then saying something different in public.
Yes, and he was very discreet about it because I tried to ask him over and over again, who are the worst offenders? And he said, I really don't think I'm going to get into that with you. But it was quite clear there were some people who were.
But when it came to people he was pleased to work with, he did name names.
He named names. He was very pleased at Nancy Pelosi often, and he said that he so wished that Barney Frank were a Republican and shared his philosophy because they really thought they could have gotten a lot done. I think he felt that Chairman Frank of the House Financial Services Committee was a very, very effective legislator who knew how to get things done.
He was working in a White House that had some really strong political ideologues, and some of the people he had the best experience working with were Nancy Pelosi and Barney Frank, Democrats. How did he navigate that divide?
I think he told the White House at times, look, we need to do something on a bipartisan basis to restore investor confidence and restore public confidence. That itself would be seen as good for the markets and good for the country. And I think he was candid in telling me that President Bush, by the end of his time in office, realized how limited his own political capital was and let Secretary Paulson take the lead on some of these controversial questions because he knew that he could be a more effective advocate.
So when people were criticizing the president for being too hands-off, Henry Paulson told you that was actually the strategy.
It was a deliberate strategy that they'd agreed on together as being the most effective, yes.
As you describe it, he really had to be persuaded to take this job. And then once he agreed to take it, he had some real questions. Based on your interviews with him, do you have the sense that he's confident he made the right choice in taking the job?
I think he told me at one point that, you know, it wasn't what he expected it would be, but it's what he signed up to do, and he did the best he could. And I think he's something sort of unusual in Washington, which is he's a very straight shooter. he was an Eagle Scout, and it's really kind of the way he acts. And
he doesn't drink, he doesn't smoke,
he has a very modest house. He's a modest house in Barrington, Illinois, near the family farm where he grew up. So he's a little bit of an odd duck for a person who came from the world he came from. And I think he has almost a sense that it became a duty for him, and he did the best he could.
he spent a lot of time working with Tim Geithner,
yep.
who's the Treasury Secretary currently. Tell me about that relationship.
I think they were very close. They worked very well together. He'd asked Tim Geithner whether he might come to Washington to be one of his deputies, and Geithner preferred to stay at the New York Federal Reserve, where he was then the president. He told me, Paulson did in one of our interviews, I think he's going to make a great Treasury Secretary someday, and of course it turned out to be exactly what happened.
And this was before he was nominated.
Oh, well before. I mean, months before.
So it's interesting. In Washington, we saw a political transfer of power from the Republicans to the Democrats, the Bush administration to the Obama administration. But in the Treasury Department, it sounds as though, well, as you describe it, there was sort of this third post-partisan group of people overseeing the economy.
There was a great deal of consistency, I have to say. I mean, the triumvirate that was working on the financial crisis a year ago was Tim Geithner, Hank Paulson, and Ben Bernanke, and two of those three are still there.
As the Obama administration was preparing to take office, he said something to you about consolidation of power in one party. What was that?
He said that he's normally not in favor of having the Congress and the presidency in the hands of the same party, and he thought that as kind of a skeptic that it would be better if there was two-party rule. I think he felt that in this particular circumstance that it might be a useful way to get some things done. I would love to talk to him now about what he thinks of the first 8 or 9 months of the Obama administration. I haven't seen him since January. That was part of our deal. He's writing his own book, which is coming out in November, so I'll be interested to see about what he says that's happened in the year since.
Todd Purdom is Vanity Fair's national editor. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Ari.
This is NPR News.